Okay, we are here to consider docket number 84736, Freedom Pack versus Reed. And you'll notice we've got Justice Hardesty participating remotely. And I don't see Justice Pickering.
Yeah, she's on the little.
Okay, she's not on my monitor.
Yeah.
Justice Pickering is participating. Oh, there it is. It's tiny. Participating from Las Vegas. So I think we are ready.
Yes, can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can. Now I can see you
thank
too.
You. Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, so counsel, we're ready to proceed. Are you ready? Okay. Come on up, and would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'm Jason Guanasso with the law firm of Hutchison & Steffen, and I represent the appellant Education Freedom Pack. For over 100 years, Nevada's Constitution has secured to the citizens of this state the power to propose by initiative petition statutes and amendments to statutes and amendments to our Nevada Constitution and then enact them or reject them at the polls. The state constitution is also required that the Nevada legislature provide by law a process and a set of procedures to facilitate the people's power to bring initiatives and referendum for consideration and vote. In 2005, the Nevada legislature enacted updates to the law that created succinct and straightforward legal requirements for filing an initiative petition. And then at the beginning of the initiative process, NRS Chapter 295, Section 9 requires proponents of an initiative petition to prepare an initiative that addresses one subject and to prepare a description of effect of not more than 200 words. Now, considering the legal sufficiency of descriptions of effect under the statute in 2013, this court held in Education Initiative PAC versus the Committee to Protect Nevada Jobs that when reviewing the legal sufficiency of a description of effect, courts must take a holistic approach to determine whether the description is straightforward, succinct, non-argumentative, and non-misleading summary of the initiative's purpose and how that purpose is to be achieved. This case is about whether the 198 words within the description of effect accompanying the initiative petition satisfies these liberal standards of review established by this court over 10 years ago.
Here, let me ask you a question before we even get into that. How many signatures have you got at this point?
Your Honor, I don't know the exact number of signatures at this point. And I think your question probably goes to whether there's an issue of mootness here. And what we would say to that is the signatures, such as they are due to be submitted on the 29th. And the reason why we have this emergency appeal before you is to give our clients an opportunity to finish gathering those signatures and to submit them before the deadline.
Do you have how many you might have?
Had they started?
They did
before
start.
Before the injunction was entered?
Yes, Your Honor, they did start before the injunction was entered, and then after the injunction was entered, they ceased collecting signatures.
But you think you can get them all before the 29th?
You know, Your Honor, that would be speculative, but what we are here for is to ask for a chance, and the statute provides a certain amount of time to get that done, and if this court gives us the relief that we're asking for, we'll have that chance. Now, if my clients fail to get the requisite signatures, it's still, whatever this court decides will still be effective because my clients, just like the appellants in the Beers case, will be able to refile and start the process over and, you know, make their case to the public, having had the benefit of review from this court.
But wouldn't that be like giving an advisory opinion for something that hasn't been filed yet?
Well, it would be if we were outside the deadline currently for gathering signatures. What we're proposing to you is that we're going to work like crazy to get those signatures in the next couple of weeks. We may fall short. Chances are we will. I don't know. I mean, we have lots of volunteers from one end of the state to the other to get that work done. But the bottom line is we're here asking for a chance. And the statute provides a window to get those signatures in. My clients have been hindered in the process by this litigation to exercise that chance, and now they're looking for this court to provide some relief so that we can get back out on the streets and gather signatures. Knowing that, again, if we fail to meet that deadline, that we have the opportunity to refile, knowing that the language that this court has approved will have effect without further litigation in the next election cycle.
Thank you.
Have you considered what if you hadn't appealed and you simply let the district court's order stand, it would carry preclusive effect down the road. So in a sense, you had to bring it here. Is that fair? Have you thought about that?
Yes, Your Honor. In my response, I omitted that, but that is another additional reason why we're here before you today.
Thank you.
So here, the description of effect that's before you satisfies the liberal requirements of this court in two ways. First, the description informs the prospective petition signer that the initiative, if approved, will allow Nevada parents the ability to use public funds to pay for their children's education in a private school and require the Nevada legislature to establish accounts and criteria for parents to utilize them. And then secondly, the description expressly informs the prospective petition signer that the initiative may require additional revenue, including a potential tax increase or reduction in government services. Now, let's be clear. This case is not about conflating the standard of review for descriptions of effect with other standards of review applied at different parts in the initiative process. Nor is this case about hypothetical pros and cons of the policy proposal presented by this initiative. The description of effect before you serves to broadly inform a petition signer about what the initiative is and what the initiative intends to accomplish if placed on the ballot and passed by the voters. And I think it's important for this court to understand, and it's important to emphasize that it's a description of effect, singular, not a description of effects, plural. And as a practical matter, this court has recognized that fact because given the limited purpose of the description of effect at this stage of the initiative process and the limited purpose or in the 200-word restriction that's required, the description of effect cannot constitutionally be required to delineate every effect or every consequence that an initiative will have. To conclude otherwise, this court has said would obstruct rather than facilitate the people's right to the initiative process.
Counsel, would this not have the effect of taking funds away from public schools, public school districts?
The initiative describes in the effect that this could result in a reduction of services or an increase of taxes, but it doesn't specify. I mean, when legislatures meet, they have to balance a budget, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to reduce funding for other public schools to channel funding to this new program.
So under this initiative, let me just clarify that, under the way this particular initiative is written and the proposed constitutional amendment it contains would not require the funds to be used for these accounts to necessarily come from funds that are otherwise going to public schools. Is that correct?
The funding source would be the DSA. And the DSA
would be the distributive school account.
It would be. And we have identified the minimum impact that would have in the description of effect. But I would caution the court with its own words. At this stage of the initiative process, the kind of analysis and the kind of discussion that we're having is really more appropriate later in the process. At this stage, we're just looking at a description of effect that won't even be seen by voters if it qualifies for the ballot. We're just looking, did this description of effect put the voters on notice of what it is that the initiative intends to do and how it intends to accomplish its goal? And so,
Mr. Ganassi, you say voters. I mean, I view the description of effect as being informative to a signatory to the petition, not to the ultimate voter. The ultimate voter gets their information out of the statutory committees that prepare arguments, including very specifically on fiscal impact. not in the description of event, correct?
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly right. Well said. And if I conflated voter with petition signer, I do apologize, but you're exactly right. Our focus at this stage is to have a 200-word description that informs a petition signer of what we're intending to amend to the Constitution and how that goal of the petition is to be accomplished. It's not to articulate every policy pro and con to this, including how much funding will be taken from one pot to fund another pot. That's for later.
Mr. Guarnaso, does Article 19, Section 6 apply to this initiative? If it doesn't, why? And if it does, how is this not an unfunded mandate?
Thank you, Your Honor, for the question. Article 19, Section 19, or Section 6 does not apply. And the reason why it doesn't is because the very plain language of the constitutional article says statutes and statutory amendments. It does not include proposed constitutional proposals or constitutional amendments. And it's not an unfunded mandate because the DSA funds that are at issue here follow the student. And in fact, last legislative session, there was quite a discussion about revamping the funding formula with the concept that the funding would follow the student. And so now our funding formula does exactly that. It follows the student and then is adjusted from school to school, district to district, based on that child's need. And so that funding for child from family A that's going to a Clark County school would then follow the child under our proposal to another private school option.
Doesn't this initiative violate the inherited deliberative functions of the legislature?
Your Honor, for two reasons, no. First of all, I think you're getting at the whether a proposed constitutional amendment, if it's enacted, could conflict with another portion of the Constitution. And we would say to you that that if there are any conflicts in the Constitution, that can be resolved by this court or another date. And secondly, the deliberative functions concept has not been decided by this court, so we don't have any precedent in this jurisdiction to address that. But what we would propose to you is that the Constitution is replete with examples of constitutional provisions that direct the legislature what to do, including in Article 11. If you read the whole of Article 11, it tells the legislature to do a lot of different things and to fund a lot of different programs related to education. And this proposal would fit squarely within that article and not do anything extraordinary that hasn't already been enacted to the Constitution relative to the legislature's power. Thank you for the question.
An additional question, if you can hear my question, Mr. Guarnaso.
Yes, I can. Thank you, Mr. Justice.
So, returning to the question earlier asked about Article 19, Section 6, and its potential application here, you distinguish this article and this proposed initiative on the basis that this initiative amends the Constitution, while Article 19, Section 6 is referencing proposals that amend statutes or statutory amendments that make appropriations or require expenditures of money. Isn't that precisely the nature of your petition? Your petition, by its own description of effect, fairly and honestly, says we're going to, there could be an increase in increase in expenditures or a loss of services, even an increase in taxes. And isn't that the exact problem that Article 19, Section 6 is concerned with? A proposal, whether it's an amendment to the Constitution that affects the Constitution, but in this case, it looks to me like this is an amendment to the Constitution that directs the legislature to either create or amend statutes that funds this. And in doing so, may require taxes. And pertinent to this question is the requirement in that article that there be a proposal to
to fund those expenditures. So I'm not sure that the distinction you offer is as clear as you suggest when your proposal seems to be doing precisely this. Setting aside the question about whether this is a limitation or an inappropriate constraint on the legislature's activity, this proposal, as I understand it, is precisely that. It proposes to create these accounts, fund these accounts, appropriate money for these accounts, and by your own admission, possibly result in a reduction of services or an increase in taxes without providing a funding mechanism for the taxes.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we're bound by the plain language of Article 19, Section 6, when it provides that limitation, number one. And clearly, this article does not apply to constitutional amendments. But with respect to the constitutionality of the proposal in total, we would propose to you that that should be taken up at a later date, not to judge the description of effect. Thank you. I see my time's up.
Hold on 1 second. Any other questions? Yeah, and we kind of chewed up your time, so I'm going to give you your full 2 minutes.
Oh, thank you.
And I'll allow your opposing colleague to have an additional 2 minutes as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices. My name is Bradley Schrager, and I'm here for the respondents in this matter. The district court found, quite rightly, that there were debilitating flaws in this particular initiative. Firstly, it is an unfunded mandate in violation of 19.6, and it doesn't provide the tax necessary. It can't do that.
Counsel, let me just stop you right there.
Sure.
So if you would please address the actual terminology of that provision that refers to statute or statutory amendment as opposed to constitutional amendment.
Right. Now, so see, that's the basic defense here, right, is that the language says this article does not permit the proposal of any statute or statutory amendment, right?
Right.
But let's look at the first words of that. It doesn't say Article 19, Section 2, Sub 3 doesn't permit that. That's the part dealing with statutory initiatives. It says this article. And so this court has previously recognized that it applies to any initiative. And there's really good reasoning for that. Look, there's no argument here, as Justice Harvey points out, that this will cost public monies, right? Money appropriated by the legislature, expenditure, all those things are in both the description and in the text itself. 19.6 applies, one, because of article, number two, because the command that it's giving to the legislature must necessarily result in the proposal of a statute or an expenditure, a public law that will spend that money. The ambit...
Let me ask you, Mr. Schrager.
Yes, sir.
I mean, statutes are by their nature intended to be very specific, where the Constitution is intended to be a basic set of laws and principles setting out the framework of state government. So isn't there kind of wisdom in the way the Constitution reads in not requiring a funding mandate for a basic constitutional amendment versus specific statutory guidelines that are being amended by the people?
I think that's an excellent question that gets to the point that the policy underlying 19.6 would absolutely apply to either kind. The policy underlying 19.6 is you don't get to, by initiative, dig a hole in the budget and then walk away and leave someone else to have to fill it. Right, we have a budgetary process here. The legislature has to come up with these monies. I mean, this court has said previously there's no de minimis requirement implicating 19.6. And when you're talking about 500,000 school children and $10,000 apiece, we're talking about theoretically upwards of $5 billion, but with just 10% of those take part in this program, you're talking about $500 million. It seems to me that the policy of reading 19.6 holistically, I mean, imagine an amendment that said on Christmas Day of 2027, the legislature shall make an expenditure that sends $1,000 to every Nevadan and then just walks away. And the legislature has to come up with that money. Seems to me that the way 19.6 is written is meant to cover And this will coincide with the issue that Justice Silver brought up regarding the initiative power. But it seems to me that the ambit of it takes in direct democracy generally, the entire article of 19, and the policies underlying them. You should not be able to do by constitutional initiative that which you specifically cannot do for very clear and important reasons by statutory initiative. And in fact, I don't really know that there's been constitutional expenditures ever in this state. So I don't know that that question has ever been addressed directly.
Well, but I think the difference would be that if you do it by constitutional amendment, which then directs the legislature to perform their function, is different than you do a statutory amendment which eliminates the legislature from doing their function.
You are still implicating the act of creating statute. You are proposing, actually here you're going beyond proposing, you are commanding the legislature to make this expenditure. So it's the combination of the reference to the entire article, that this is not just a proposal, but beyond that, a command, and that achieves the very thing that 19.6 seeks to make sure we never do, which is dig that budgetary hole and walk away from it. I think that, in a holistic way, brings this petition under the ambit of Article 19, Section 6. Now, the second sort of absolutely fatal flaw in this, there are three major flaws identified by the district court. Two of them are fatal. One of them we just talked about, the unfunded mandate. The other one is the impermissible use of the initiative process. Again, just like with the public cost, there's no argument here that the petition doesn't contain a command to the legislature. It's telling the legislature, you need to go do this. Beyond that, it's commanding a specific legislature, the 83rd legislature in 2025. And there are three legislative shalls here. Shall provide by law for the establishment of the accounts. Shall appropriate money to fund it. Shall provide by law for eligibility criteria.
So what's the provision of our constitution or law that would say they can't do that?
It is inherent in the legislative existence, in what a legislature is. Legislatures must be free to consider and deliberate individual. Every legislature is constituted independently. When the people are acting in their through their initiative power, they are acting in their legislative capacity, which means they are acting in some ways as a legislature, not with full legislative powers, but in the enactment sense. It's axiomatic that no legislature could order a future legislature to pass a bill. You couldn't, for example, have one legislature enact or pass a constitutional amendment and order the succeeding legislature to pass it as well.
But there are constitutional provisions that require legislation for expenditures, are there not?
There are. But that
are
does,
they
that does,
unconstitutional?
No. What is unconstitutional is directing the next legislature to pass that bill. And I think it's illustrated sort of simply by an example, which has to do with the remedy. Let's order the 83rd legislature in 2025 to pass this. What if it doesn't?
Right.
What are you going to do? I mean, let's be perfectly frank. Is this court going to issue a writ of mandamus, not just to the legislature, but to individual legislatures, to pass a tax that requires a supermajority? I mean, that is literally unthinkable. In fact, we've thought it before. Some of you may remember the fateful summer of 2003 and the Gwynne v. Legislature case. And, looking back on that, Justice Maupin's dissent in that case hit it right on the head, which he, and I'm sort of paraphrasing on behalf of Justice Maupin, what are we doing here? I'm not going to send a mandamus over to the legislature. That's not our task. As we've been talking a lot about separation of powers, this is the danger when you get into commanding legislatures to do something, and then what happens otherwise? What if it was legislature versus...
The Constitution does that in a number of different circumstances.
The Constitution... Well, I think every example of that not only is organic, meaning original to the Constitution, the setting up of government initially, and secondly, predates the initiative power. right? So by oftentimes 60 years. We didn't have the initiative power until 1912. So the specific question of whether the people acting in their legislative capacity can usurp and commandeer the legislative deliberative power of a future legislature would not have been in question back in 1864. It is in question now. And
it's kind of a slippery slope to say we created a constitution and then we created the power for the people to initiate changes to the constitution, but well, we don't want you to change that. Well, we don't want you to do it in that way.
No, but that's a subject matter.
That's where I fear we're getting a little more into what I fear Judge McGee did, into opining about the merits of the petition and whether people will vote for it or not versus is the process proper and should it move forward?
I don't think the issue is that there's been a deprivation of the right to pursue this petition. There's simply an absence of a requirement in Article 6 to provide a revenue source.
I think that's true.
That's what the article requires.
I think that's true. I would like to get to your question. Let me just wrap up on, if I may, on legislative deliberation, because I was thinking earlier today, what if it had been legislature versus Gwynn? And you had an issue, a writ of mandamus to a governor not to veto something. I mean, these are the separation of powers demands that each branch and each player in the branch observe its particular role. And sort of simply put, if you want to do something by initiative, do it. Write the statute. Write a proper constitutional initiative. Don't order the legislature to do it. You can't do that. Right? So that, once again, fatal to the petition to do that. Now let's talk a little bit about Judge McGee's concerns about the description of a fact, which I think is where you were heading with that, Justice Herndon. Justice McGee, it was a really interesting hearing. He was incredibly curious.
Can I interrupt you real quick? By the way, I checked a couple of hours ago, and I'm just going to ask you all. It doesn't appear that there still have been any transcripts prepared from the hearing that we could have access to.
I didn't request one.
Okay.
I think there was a transcript request on file.
I think there was a request on file by counsel.
Okay.
We didn't request one.
They haven't been filed. So, but anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Were you to read it, you would see a oftentimes when you have arguments, there's the presentation, there's the rebuttal, there's the reply. Right. Sit down. Here's my order. That was not this hearing. This hearing was very free flowing, the district court proved itself to be very curious about all aspects and had read many of the cases and wanted to have an open discussion. And we went on for a very long time. In the end, he intuited what was exactly right, which is there are significant problems, both factual and otherwise, in the description of effect, beyond the sort of fatal flaws that I've already pointed out. What he found, what is exactly right, is first of all, there is a sort of factual misstatement or a highly misleading portion of the description of effect regarding the amount of funding. And that has to do with the ways in which both the initiative and the description deal with what support we're talking about. What is the support we are identifying that's now going to go from the public fisc to parents? Now, in the text of the amendment, it says the amount of funding that will otherwise be used to support the education of that child, public funding. And we will return to the otherwise and that child momentarily. The description of effect first says, or first references, the public support that would be used for that child. Now, total public support, the amount the legislature sets aside for that purpose is a matter of law. SB 458 of the last session defines total public support as all money appropriated directly for the support of the public schools in this state, including, without limitation, the statewide base per pupil funding, adjusted base per pupil funding, additional weighted funding, and on and on other monies. That's the total public support. That averages out to over $10,000 per child, and that's in the bill as well. However, in the description of effect, it switches from talking about total public support, which is actually what's in the text of the measure itself, to give examples regarding only the statewide base per pupil. Now, as I've just explained, the statewide base per pupil is only one component of total public support. Now, in that way, what they've said here, which is that the statewide base per pupil is $6,980 or $7,074, that's ostensibly true. It's just irrelevant to the measure. The actual total support averages out at more than $10,000. And you might say, well, what's the real difference there? That's 30%. Right? Now, I don't know which way that cuts. I don't know whether somebody would say, I'm not going to vote for it, or I'm not going to sign this petition because it's too much or too little. I have no idea. What I do know is if you're going to put the numbers in there, you should be accurate with them. And if you've done it so that it seems like it's less expensive than it would be, and I'm not saying they did that, it could be just an error. If the result is it looks less expensive than it would have been, that's problematic, and that's misleading, even if it's not intentional, and should be corrected.
They have apparently argued, I think, sorry if I'm misstating it, but that you know, if the numbers are wrong, put the right numbers in and let's move on. How would you respond?
Yeah, I mean, if you think those numbers need to be there at all, maybe they don't need to be there. But if they're going to be there, and that's not my decision for them, if they're going to be there, they better be right. You better be describing something relating to what's in the text of the measure, which is total support, right? And, you know, even that's this is a difficult thing to describe because, you know, there is no check with little Johnny's name on it that says this is for your schooling this year. It's a way of expressing the totality of school funding. And it doesn't even do that very well because, you know, in a county like Esmeralda, there are different costs spread differently, and it's $23,000 per child.
They take attendance at school precisely because there is a dollar amount attached with Johnny attending school each day, right?
They take attendance at school so that for total enrollment purposes,
okay. They
can come up with the total number, which then can be expressed by dividing that by the number of students, right? But there's still no, hey, here's your $7,000, Mr. Schrager. It is just a way of expressing. And it's like that because schools, unsurprisingly, have hard costs. It doesn't matter how many kids in Esmeralda County, you know, take this program. You're still going to have maintenance and custodians and electricity and all those things. So it's simply taking this number is a very strange way of expressing it to begin with. But that was their choice.
But they don't necessarily have to solve all those issues at that time. I mean,
they
could just say, look, we're going to make portable the amount of the funding assigned per student. And when we do that, that could result in a reduction of services or increase in taxes somewhere else to make up for it. I mean, that would probably be
absolutely
sufficient.
Absolutely, they could. But you just used the word could. That could result in a tax increase or a reduction in government services. That also bothered Judge McGee because the reality is there's no other option. I mean, you're taking public money for use here, and you're moving it over there. That money has to be replaced. It either has to be replaced by new revenue, or it has to be replaced by reduction of services. There are no other options.
Well, if you have less students, you probably need less services. If you have less students, you might need less schools. I mean, I'm just trying to conceptualize.
Sure.
What you're saying.
But the sort of basic notion that this money must be replaced. And you know, we just heard an admission for the first time that it would come from the distributive schools account. I had heard that before. I do know that in the measure itself, may I just finish my sentence, Your Honor? In the measure itself, and this also bothered Judge McGee, you know, there's no discussion of the impact on public schools generally. I understand that because that, you know, you could argue that that's speculative, that that's a bridge too far. But the words of the measure include the word otherwise. The legislature shall appropriate money to fund each account in an amount comparable to the amount of funding that would otherwise be used for that child. That to me indicates, because judges are going to have to deal with this language in the future, otherwise means I had this here, it was for schooling, but we're going to use it otherwise for something else. So, you know, the description of effect doesn't capture that it is, in effect, moving money from public schools away from public schools. Not that there's some pot of money that's going to magically appear that's got nothing to do with public schools. The inclusion of the word otherwise, which is just as problematic as the inclusion of the phrase that child, right, which is also a sort of weird way of putting, you know, I mean, what is as Judge McGee noted, the notion that someone in Esmeralda County or some other county with a special needs child who has much greater need for public monies, if you get down to that math, that child isn't going to get the support, right? So the sort of interaction.
Did that answer your question? Okay, very good. Colleagues, any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. The debate over the policy or the efficacy of the policy that's encapsulated in this language is a great debate, but it's not a debate that should be occurring right now. It's a debate that takes place later in the process.
No, counsel, but is it an accurate description of effect as if it says, well, yeah, it could require tax increase or reduced services when, in fact, it specifically requires pulling money from the public school account and giving it to individual parents to go elsewhere? Like, isn't that a difference? Doesn't that make it misleading?
And no, Your Honor, respectfully, no. The description of effect puts the public on notice, the petition signer on notice, of what we're proposing, and then how that proposal might have an effect. But it can't go into that. The council provided 8 pages of briefing on the funding formula. To ask us at this stage to put that into a description of effect would contradict your previous case law on descriptions of effect. Second, I'd like to provide a hypothetical. Assume just with me, with regard to the Constitution, that today we were proposing that the legislature should provide for a uniform system of public schools. Or assume that we were presenting a petition today that said the legislature shall provide for the establishment of a state university, both within Article 11. If we take council's position and some of the questions that have been asked to their logical conclusion, that would mean that those sorts of constitutional amendments would be unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Constitutions, by their nature, direct legislatures to do things. This court, the legislature, the executive branch are all creatures of the Constitution. And if it takes funding to fund these three branches of government, the legislature must do it. And so with that, we would submit to you that this description of effect meets this court's criteria for what qualifies. We thank you for your time.
Okay, colleagues, any questions?
Chief Justice Perry, I have a question.
Okay.
I'd like to ask him what standard of review he contends applies to our evaluation of the description of effect finding by the district court.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe this is a question of law, and this court reviews this question of law de novo, meaning no deference is due to the lower court.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
Council,
you.
Thank you for the briefing and the argument today. The matter will stand submitted, and the court will stand in recess until the next call of the court.